Hi there, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in East Asian Studies. Welcome and thanks for joining us again. I just spoke with Eugene Park about his book, A Family of No Prominence, The Descendants of Pak Tokwa and the Birth of Modern Korea. This came out in 2014 with Stanford University Press. Now, the book works simultaneously on a number of different levels. It's the exploration of a particular family, a particular descent line. It's an exploration of the larger social, political, and cultural contexts within which that descent line emerged and wrote its own history and either kept or not the kind of documentation that allows us to write that history. And it's also, at a kind of broader level, a study of the possibilities of writing genealogies and the possibilities of writing with genealogical history as well. So the book focuses in on this particular family, in part because of its relationship with the author. And Gene talks about that relationship both in the book and in the course of our conversation in, I think, really, really interesting ways. The chapters each, along the lines that I've just described, work on a number of different levels as well. So each chapter looks at the history of the status group that the Pak family was part of, this Chungnyeon status group, and situates the Paks within that history of the status group, and then situates both of them within a larger history of the kind of continual modernizing of Korea at the same time. So it's a really interesting story. It's full of lots of vignettes and anecdotes that we only scratch the surface of in the course of our conversation. So I urge you to look at that. I mean, stories of people who really like to drink getting hungover, and then their sisters have to, you know, do their jobs for them the next day because they're too hungover to work. Also stories of really courageous individuals, stories of women, stories of men, fathers, daughters, in-laws. It's a really fascinating chapter in a history of family as well as a history of historical genealogy. So it was really a pleasure to talk with Gene about it, and I hope you enjoy the conversation and have a chance to take a look at the book afterwards. Thanks for listening. I'm here today to talk with Eugene Park about his new book, A Family of No Prominence. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, Gene, and thanks very much for making the time to talk with me today. I'm really looking forward to this.
Thank you.
So, Gene, could you start us off by saying just a little bit about your background, and specifically, what brought you to study and work on modern Korean history?
Did you mean personal background or academic background or both?
Well, whatever was responsible for bringing you to the decision to study modern Korean history as your chosen academic field.
Sure. I was born in South Korea, so my family and I moved to the United States when I was 12. The one word that I think best describes my identity as a Korean American, or better yet, the so-called 1.5. Ever since my childhood, even as a child, I was very much interested in history. That was definitely my favorite subject. But in stark contrast from many East Asian families, where the parents are the ones who seem to know a lot about history or family history, and they want to talk about family history with their children. Our family was the opposite in that my parents had little interest in history. And I think looking back, that thirst for information, the lack of information about our family kept on really encouraged me to pursue history, eventually study history as my college major, and pursue graduate education, become a professional historian. It's interesting that you also asked me what encouraged me to study modern history. Actually, it was not until about a few years ago that I thought I had a real interest in modern era. What I mean by modern here is, let's say, from late 19th century on. So until more recently, I was comfortably grounded in the Joseon period from 1392 to, although it ended in 1910, I would say more like the Joseon period before the impact of Western imperialism. And also, even to this day, I have an ongoing, long-standing interest in the ancient period, the early Korea, early the ancient period, ancient history of essentially all parts of the world. Now, I mentioned a moment ago that fairly recently, a few years ago, I became interested in modern Korea. And what happened was, and that's when I, that this interest, the beginning point, more or less coincides with this particular book project, which began about 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. So this is actually relevant to, and this is really nicely a segue into my next question, and it's really relevant to the project. And you talk a little bit about your own personal connection with the project in the book itself. So the book we're talking about today explores the history of a particular family, the nature of the status group that it's part of, and the kinds of genealogical concepts and sources that shape its history in the course of Korea's modernization, modernizing Korea's place in modern history. So you talk a little bit in the book about what brought you to this topic, but can you talk for listeners who haven't yet had a chance to read the book about how you came to work on this topic in particular, and how you came to decide to publish your work on this topic as a book-length object?
Mm-hmm. I have always liked history, of all kinds, not just macro level history, but also family history, including genealogy. I suppose I am interested in how all things connect, especially animals, most certainly including primates, including human beings. And when I arrived at Harvard University in 1991 for my graduate training, first of all, my advisor, late Ed Wagner, had been working with Korean genealogies, Chokbo, for decades. And Harvard Yenching Library had a sizable collection of Korean genealogies. I was just, I considered myself enjoying the paradise at the time. I remember just spending hours in the sub-basement of the Harvard Yenching Library, going through those dusty, moldy, often moldy volumes of old Korean Chokbo. And before long, I was able to not only trace the ancestries of both my maternal grandfather and maternal grandmother, but I suppose in line with Western custom of more Western custom of tracing one's ancestry through various routes rather than just limiting oneself to patrilineal ancestry as do East Asians. Before long, I ended up with at least back then perhaps hundreds of my ancestors, direct ancestors. Now it's more like 13,000, and yet. I made no progress whatsoever with my father's side, and the breakthrough came only, and if I, I'm not sure if I have the year down, but 2004, I believe, mm-hmm. when I finally found my paternal great-grandfather in a military regiment record. I was absolutely convinced that it was the right person. And from that point on, it was easy tracing the researching on the history of that side of my family, because people connected to him, people that he associated with, many individuals, some of them actually are known persons in historiography of Korea. But interestingly, as I mentioned in my prologue, for most of these individuals, the standard references have little or if nothing to say about their backgrounds.
Right, and you actually mentioned, I think, in the book that this breakthrough happened on your birthday. Right?
Yes.
It's a really nice cosmic coincidence. So your the patrilineal family that you associate with is the family that you trace in the book. And so there's this really interesting and really fascinating connection there. And we'll talk about that over the course of our conversation, I'm sure. So as you just mentioned, and you talk about this very early in the prologue, many modern Koreans are not terribly concerned with their ancestral genealogies. And so the book asks a couple of questions related to this. And I'll just use the phrasing in the book because I think it's much more elegant than I can reproduce. So the book asks, how did so many Korean families lose the memory of their past? And also, as a related point, what does the series of changes in how families think about their past tell us about Korea's transition from a largely agrarian, rigidly status-bound society to a modernizing nation-state, to a Japanese colony, to a land governed by an industrialized democracy in the south and a totalitarian regime in the north? And so that's a quote from the book, and I think it really nicely encapsulates the different levels at which this study works. And so you're focusing in on a particular family that sort of opens up into a history of the status group it's part of, which opens up into a history of Korea, which opens up into a history of modernity. So it's a really nice layering, and it goes all the way down to your own personal experience as well as a member of that patrilineal descent group, as you talk about early in the book. Now, the book explores these issues by looking at the story of this family in the context of its status as middle people or chungin. So because this status group is such an important part of the book, could you maybe start us off by talking about chungin? What is the nature of this group, and what do we need to understand about this group now in order to understand the kind of historical contribution you're making to the history of this group in the book?
Mm-hmm. In answer to that question, I may as well quickly survey the status hierarchy of late Joseon Korea. Mm-hmm. So the top of the social pyramid, if you will, was, of course, a small percentage of the population, definitely no more than, say, 5%, as is true in any early modern Eurasian society, that is the hereditary aristocracy. There were various terms for late Joseon aristocracy. One commonly used term in the Western language historiography is a yangban, which literally means this, the two officials or two lines or two orders of officials, namely civil and military branches. Whereas in early in the Goryeo period, the term yangban had a more literal connotation, meaning of civil and military officials. But definitely, certainly by the late Joseon period, the term yangban had become synonymous with a hereditary aristocracy, the members of whom had the privileged, if not almost exclusive, access to the most meaningful offices in the government. And it was a status that one had to be born with. It was not something one could achieve through merit. Since you're a sinologist, I may as well mention that the character ideograph is pronounced Sa in Korean, sure, in Chinese as in literati, or the sajok, I guess the family or the group of literati. That's another commonly used term for yangban for Korean history. Just below the aristocracy, yangban aristocracy was the next group, the chungin, the term which literally means the middle people. The narrow definition of chungin refers to various technical specialists, experts in different branches of knowledge or fields, such as foreign languages, mm-hmm. Medicine, accounting, astronomy or astrology, depending on how you want to understand pre-20th century science, and a range of other disciplines. These experts were employed by the government, and they lived in the capital city, Seoul, for generations. And their family members had privileged, if not, well, I should say exclusive access to such positions in the government. So that's a narrow definition, chungin. Whereas the broadest definition, chungin, would also include under this rubric, illegitimate children of Yangban aristocratic parents, well, as fathers, also various administrative functionaries employed by central and the local government offices, or yamen clerks, if you will, also the regional elites of Northern Korea. The reason behind, reason for including them in the Chungin category is that regardless of how well-educated or wealthy these Northerners were, and some even have passed examinations and held offices, the aristocracy of a Central and Southern Korea refused to recognize the Northern elite as their social peer. Although I should admit that, there is still some disagreement among scholars as to whether whether or not we can regard the Northern elite as a Yangban. Yangban. But going back to my definition for Chungin, still was a fairly small status category, perhaps no more than 10-15% of the population max. And then below them, of course, were the commoners, the bulk of whom, majority of whom, were farmers. And what makes early modern Korea, late Joseon Korea, unique compared to Tokugawa Edo Japan and Qing China is the existence of a chattel slavery, the unfree population making up as large as much as 30% of the population until the late 18th century, when as the late Joseon economy became more commercialized, the slave population began to decline rapidly until the government finally decided to do away with the system in 1894.
Great. Thank you so much. Now, you talk in the book about some of the ways that your understanding and treatment of Chungin differs from that of previous studies. And some of those ways are about treating this, if I understood correctly, and let me know if I'm not, but treating this category as encompassing a greater variety of specialist families and also taking longer to take shape in modern Korea than was previously understood. And so this is part of how you're historicizing this group in a way that's, as I understand it, different from how previous scholars have done it. It's really interesting. So the time frame of the book moves us from medieval and early modern contexts through recent modernity, and it focuses on the Myeryong Pak family, as we've talked about just very briefly before. Now, during the period under consideration, the family's social status improves, and we see that happening, and they move from commoners to Chungin. They do this through a very careful investment of their resources of various types, and we'll talk about that over the course of the conversation. Now, one of the really interesting things happening in the prologue is that you talk about an apparent contradiction here, right? It was, and that contradiction is this, and I'll kind of just sum it up. It was the increased success and the increased prominence of this family during the period of Korea's modernization that actually led to their exclusion from what you call modern Korea's hegemonic discourse on descent. So in the modern era, Chungin and their descendants increasingly were kind of ambivalent towards genealogies, and this is a change. And as such, this becomes not a very easy topic to study for the historian. So on that note, let's talk a little bit about what it was for you to study this topic in terms of the sources, in terms of the kinds of materials that you explored and brought to bear in creating a history of this family specifically and of the Chungin in general. So you mentioned the importance of written genealogies or chokbo early on in the text. So can you talk a little bit about those kinds of sources and their importance or the kind of interesting things about them in terms of your study in this context?
Mm-hmm. Of course, extant sources, primary sources, especially before the modern era, overwhelmingly favor the elite, and early modern Korea, late Joseon Korea, is not exceptional in this regard. I should also admit, I'm almost embarrassed to admit this, is that although I consider myself a professional historian, only after I discovered who my patrilineal ancestors were. And also this learning process continues as I keep unearthing or discovering direct ancestors of an even lower social status. I realized that even a professional historian myself, I am so accustomed to reading about and talking about famous individuals, famous families, that even without realizing, I assume that somehow my ancestors could have been one of them, or my ancestors were examination passers or government officials or intellectuals or whatnot. And I think the one reason why someone like myself, at least initially 10 years ago, had that room for imagination or if not wishful thinking, was that, the blank slate, that is a lack of knowledge about the real ancestors. And this is true for the most Koreans today. Now, to comment on written genealogies, just to help our listeners have a better sense of how widespread or limited the phenomenon of genealogy compilation is, contrary to common claims made in this mainstream South Korean media that every Korean household has a set of a genealogy or chokpo, my own research and experience suggests to me that less than half, perhaps no more than 30-40% of South Koreans can find themselves in a written genealogy of any edition. And among those who can, less than half of them actually belong there. Of course, so what this means is that for South Koreans today who can find themselves or their family members or their recent ancestors in a published or written genealogy, unless they are of true Yangban descent, the most of the rest have simply made their ways into their genealogy. They come from families that have descent lines that have made their ways into genealogies only in the last perhaps 200-300 years. So where does Jungin fit in to all this? Just like the Yangban, as of the mid or the late 19th century, Jungin had kept their own genealogical records or genealogies. But as I argue in my book, especially toward the end, once the Jungin in the late 19th, early 20th century began espousing, adopting, embracing Western institutions and ideas, and also take pride in their stance as the enlightened people, in contrast to those who are backward, a majority of them simply stopped participating in the old custom or the culture of genealogy compilation. And this is precisely what makes it very difficult for one to conduct research on Jungin, because it's very hard to connect the Jungin of a late Joseon period with their modern-day, modern-era descendants.
Mm-hmm. But connects them, you did actually in the course of the book, in part through written or in part through interviews and oral histories. So can you talk a little bit about those as sources? What were some of the most important contributions that those oral interviews made to the project? Were there any particular challenges in that process? And or were there any moments during the process of conducting these oral interviews that really stand out for you as transformative in terms of the way you were thinking about the project?
Yes, my oral interviews were absolutely critical for my research and in the end what I could piece together. What immediately comes up in my mind is, above all, the difficulty the fact that the most informants or interviewees, they're not going to be able to give you the kind of information that historians value, like the exact names, dates, years, places. Much of their memory is built or has survived around the more general types of information. I guess without degrading or putting down women's, the so-called the old wives' tale type of information. Secondly, these memories or details or the stories have survived using words and conceptual categories that generally often do not match the terms or the concepts that that the historiography uses. So, for example, the term 중인, only after I had been talking to one particularly informative interviewee for a long time, and I had pieced together a considerable amount of information, bits of information, and then she just came from nowhere and says, yes, she now remembers her mother telling her and her siblings that, yes, we're Jungin. But it's not, definitely not a term or a concept that the ordinary Koreans think about or talk about when they write about or discuss their own ancestry today. And also, perhaps a third point I could make about oral history is when one is lucky, then the best case scenario is when the bits and pieces, the types of information that the informant gives, one is able to check the written sources, primary sources, and verify who that particular person is or the place is. For example, this person is a member of the Wu family that my book highlights in chapter 5. Ever since I was a child, I remember hearing stories about how this particular person, Wu Kim Young, well, I didn't know the name until I wrote this book. He was married to my paternal grandfather's sister. He was very wealthy. He had passed, they didn't say he passed the particular type of exam, but everyone addressed him as a literary licentiate, or Wu Jinza. Actually, Jinza is the same character as the Chinese term of Jinshir, presented scholar, Jinza. So at least I know his surname is Wu. He lived in the particular places. I know there's practically only one ancestral seat that goes with the surname Wu among those who produced, among the Wus who passed the examination during this particular type of examination during the Joseon period. But it was not until this one informant recalled that this literary licentiate Wu's father was addressed by everyone or referred to by everyone as the Korean term is the court office, name of the court office is Shijong, which is a minor, largely honorary post, meaning that ostensibly meaning that the one is the chamberlain of the royal household, Wu Shijong, and that did it. That was the critical information that finally got to nail down who this literary licentiate Wu, that is my grandfather's sister's husband was. But I have to say that the such lucky ideal matches are relatively rare when one works with both oral history and the written documents.
Great. For any earlier career or younger scholars who, or more advanced scholars who might be interested in starting to get into the production of oral histories as part of their work. Do you have any like major points of advice or things that you wish you would have known early on in the process that you learned as a, you know, in terms of trial or as a trial and error kind of process that you would pass along from your experience?
Of course, as soon as one realizes or decides that he or she is going to study a particular group of people, then one must really hurry to tap into the wisdom, the memory of the oldest member of that group. And one really strong regret I have is that that I did not get to ask all these questions when my paternal grandmother was still alive. She was born in 1894. She passed away in the early 80s. And so I remember her well since I lived in Korea until 12. She would have, had she been around and had I asked her questions back then, I'm sure this book would be much thicker. The stories would be more interesting, perhaps even more pictures, as I would have had better ideas to where to go to track down some interesting illustrations or photographs. But no. But on the other hand, I shouldn't be too harsh on myself in that as a kid, yes, I wanted to hear stories about our family, our ancestors, but of course, I did not have the conceptual preparation or the background or the tools to ask these questions to my grandmother, who was in her, if I recall, 80s at the time.
Of course. Thank you. So let's actually get into some of the chapters. Now, we won't have even though you just mentioned that there would have been even more interesting stories, there already are a whole lot of really fascinating stories and images in here. We won't have time to get to all of them, but we can at least try to get to some of them and some of the highlights. So the first chapter considers the origins of the Pak, and also, it also considers the origins of the Chongyin status group. And it considers this as a historical problem as well as a historical topic that you're researching. So can you maybe start off by talking a little bit about the formation of Chongyin status in this early context? In what way did it emerge as a status group, and what do we need to understand about that emergence as a fact and or a historiographical problem in order to understand what comes next?
Mm-hmm. Even in the Goryeo period, as a Korea's medieval period, there certainly was a social stratum, people of a social status lower than that of the central aristocracy, but higher than that of the commoners and slaves. But it was not until the late Joseon period, Korea's early modern era, when we get the capital resident, technical specialist, Chongyin families that constituted a closed status group or category, in the sense that they married among themselves for generations, and they monopolized the technical positions in the government. But not only that, okay, while they complained about, and they were certainly bitter about their exclusion from more important, powerful, meaningful positions in central officialdom, they themselves also made sure that the people of a lower social status could not threaten their privileges or positions from below. And the one the relevant fact that I uncovered in the process of my research was that that in the same way the Yangban aristocratic families discriminated against the illegitimate children, the Chongyin themselves did exactly the same. In fact, as I point out in my book, my own line seems to be descended from an illegitimate son of son Aba Chunying. And this discovery directly contradicts my graduate school advisor, late Edward Wagner's speculative observation at the time. And I remember him articulating this quite well, his observation that perhaps maybe because Chunying themselves suffer from the discriminatory treatment by the aristocracy, they themselves may have been more flexible, more open-minded about the issue of illegitimacy. But my own research, as well as more recent studies by other scholars, suggest that the Chunying certainly were not any better in that regard compared to Yangban.
Fascinating. So as we move from this very earliest period further into the book, we move into a chapter that looks at Chunying in general and the Pacs in particular in the 18th century. Now, the 18th century was crucial, as you show here, for the history of the Pacs, as it was this period in which they kind of emerged from obscurity and establish their wealth, their social status. They relocate from what you call a sleepy rural locale to Seoul. And in part, they do this in terms, or they do this by choosing marriage partners. Okay. So you talk about over the course of this chapter the importance of the fact that it's based on a much greater body of historical documents than you had access to for this, you know, the very earliest stages in the first chapter. You also talk about the challenges as a historian in tracing descent lines through these documents. So can you perhaps talk a little bit about that? For you, in the context of the work being done in this chapter on the 18th century, what were some of the challenges for you in even, you know, tracing descent lines through the documents? And what's, you know, maybe the most important element of that process for you?
The most obvious challenge was to find additional information on the various individuals who appear in the Pak genealogy, but other than their birth year, death year, the gravesite location, the surnames and ancestral seats of their wives, and the names of their fathers-in-law, it was a real challenge to find any additional information in other types of sources. But as you mentioned, and as my book certainly mentions as well, more and more information becomes available as I make my way through the 17th century, the 18th century, and by the beginning of the 19th century, then we have, we're looking at a bona fide Chunying specialist, Chunying family. The second challenge, or the difficulty for me, was that, of course, there one can find persons, multiple individuals with the same name from the same, roughly the same time period. But then how do we know if it's the person that I am looking for? And that's where we have to consider much room for interpretation, if not even if not educated guesses or even speculation. In some cases, it was the match was quite obvious. There were too many matches in terms of the surname, the given name, the where the person lived, and what the person should have been doing or most likely would have been doing occupation-wise, and how he was related to someone or his types of individuals that he knew. So certain matches, some matches were quite certain. I had no room for doubt, whereas there were some that I had to be the matches that were speculative in nature, including this one particular the member Pak, who I believe chapter 4 discusses, the man who was a member of the chosen Korea as the mission to Tsushima in 1811. Mm-hmm.
So let's actually, let's get to him soon. And let's get to that chapter soon. First, though, I want to set the stage a little bit for that discussion of that chapter by talking about the chapter that comes before. This is chapter 3, As a Middle People, Military Officers, Jurists, and Calligraphers. So this chapter looks at the elevation in status of the Pak family by the early 19th century and situates this within the broader context of Korea's increasing engagement with a kind of new world and new forms of imperialism. So in addition to military careers, which had dominated the descent line previous to this, in the 19th century, you show that members of the Pak family were also pursuing careers in other technical specialties and were marrying into families that were doing the same. And so those specialties included interpretation. Some of them were physicians. Now, two really interesting elements of this story, though, emerge and wind up becoming increasingly important later on. And that is their engagement with Catholicism on the one hand, and also with Enlightenment thought more generally. So could you talk a little bit about the importance of those elements of this story, or really, you know, either one of them that you might be particularly interested in talking about?
I think you meant Protestantism rather than Catholicism.
Oh, sorry. Right? Yes. I must have, yeah.
No sure. problem. Yeah, Protestantism. And I'm sorry, what was the other one?
There was one you more. Mentioned the importance of engagement with Enlightenment thought.
Yes. Sure. In essence, Protestantism was seen as a part of the overall Enlightenment ideology or thought. Interestingly, the Korean intellectuals, Koreans who talked about or who dealt with or were conscious about the Enlightenment thoughts left the civilization part out of the name, unlike the Japanese who spoke of a civilization and Enlightenment. Mm-hmm. And the reason being here, the reason being that in the case of Koreans who at least initially were more measured and conservative Western ideas, they strongly believed that the civilization was not an issue here. That is, Korea traditionally was a full-fledged member of the civilization or civilized world, the center of which happened to be China. So civilization was not a question here. But interestingly, Enlightenment was an issue and a challenge, in that there were certain things, ideas, and institutions that the Koreans could learn about, study, and adopt from the West. So as such, in that context, Chung-in, the northern elite of Korea in particular, welcomed Protestantism, which also the welcoming, espousing Protestantism also had a psychological dimension to it, in the sense that by the Russo-Japanese War, as a way that the Japanese, by 1904, 1905, when Korea found itself in a helpless situation with Japanese aggression, and eventually leading to Japanese annexation of Korea in 1910. Such progressive Koreans were drawn to Protestantism for psychological reasons, almost as if that this new faith could offer atonement for the sins of their ancestors, their various wicked practices and customs. And this certainly was, I think, the main reason why, if not the sole reason, one of the two reasons, the other one being the attraction to Enlightenment ideology. So the reason why the Pak Tae-shik, my own great-grandfather, decided to get baptized in 1905.
Great. Thank you. So I'm looking back into the chapter does mention Chunyin engagement with Catholicism in particular, right? Why is that distinction between, why is it important maybe for, so that I understand also, so that listeners understand when they look at that chapter, for us to distinguish in this context between Chunyin engagement with Catholicism and with Protestantism in particular, in terms of the kind of story being told here?
Mm-hmm. Are you referring to there's one individual who was recognized today as the first Korean Catholic martyr.
I'm thinking of, and you know, the details are like not important, but I'm thinking of the discussion, I think on page 50, you mentioned that some Chunyin turned to what constituted in that context radically new practices such as Catholicism.
Oh.
So, no. It's, I think this is interesting because I'm just raising it because it's part of the kind of work that the book does that's really, really interesting is to ask us to think about, you know, these larger distinctions and these larger issues and as they're coming into the society for the first time and how that's shaping the history of these status groups that had existed. And so if there's something that we can just maybe leave it, and if there's something that we need to understand about that distinction, we'll kind of, you know, you can mention it later.
Yeah. Good that I had my book with me just in case. And I'm looking at the page. Yeah, I found the reference. Oh, I see. Yes, here I'm talking about this part of the book discuss is how the late Joseon and Chunyin, although they many were wealthy, they had their horizon intellectual and the geographical horizon were wider than many, if not most, the Yangban at the time. Their opportunities, their positions in the power structure, in the sense of a central officialdom, were limited. In that context, this part of the book is discussing how Catholicism, which Korean visitors to China came to learn about and study through their, especially through their meetings with Jesuits and other European missionary Europeans in China at the time. Yes, Catholicism was gaining a following in late Joseon Korea, and the Chunyin technical specialist Chunyin constituted an important element among the growing number of Catholics at the time.
Awesome. So you mentioned this sort of incorporate the importance of the incorporation of the Chunyin within these larger power structures, and I think that really beautifully takes us into chapter 4, which really expands on this and looks at further transformations. It's a particularly fascinating chapter. So this chapter kind of continues what's happening in chapter 3 by looking explicitly at the PUC's adjustment to the influence of Western ideas and institutions and practices prior to the takeover by the Japanese in 1905. Now, you mentioned like none of the PACs at this time were kind of prominent enough to have made it into previous histories of this period, but you're bringing us into a context in which they, the Chunyin actually become really interestingly significant. So you talk in particular about the involvement of specialist Chunyin in the building of the empire's new Western capital and the kind of impact of this upwardly mobile aspect of Chunyin status at this point on the kinds of genealogies that were produced as a result. So this is super interesting from a historian's point of view as well as a historiographical point of view. So could you talk about that or sort of whatever elements of this part of the story that you feel are most important and interesting?
Mm-hmm. As you or some readers may sense, I was most excited about writing this chapter. I didn't used to be, before I began working on this book project, 1890s and 1900s to me was constituted the tail end of the Joseon Dynasty, a depressing story. I remember when I was a graduate student, Ed Wagner at one point during our directed reading courses said, this is a very frustrating period to read about for Korea. And I certainly appreciated his love and special feeling that he had for Korea at the time. But As my research on this book continued, I was struck by how the 1890s and 1900s, more precisely the period of the Korean Empire, Imperial Korea from 1897 to 1910, well, I should say 1904, because once the Russo-Japanese War broke out, the Korea was in the Japanese control, under Japanese control. During that seven-year period, I think the Koreans of some specialized skills and influence and wealth, such as the Pak, found new opportunities. They were being appreciated and awarded by the imperial government, which, of course, was bent on building a modern nation state with the wider social base for support. I mean, after all, one cannot build a strong modern nation state without a population base, a large population that understands what it means to be loyal citizens or the subjects of a modern nation state. In that sense, the education is important. And also, once you have a patriotic, dutiful citizens, it becomes, I suppose it's supposed to become easier for the central government to recruit its citizens to fight in a modern army, and if necessary, give up, sacrifice their lives for the national glory. So this certainly was, for me, as I was writing this chapter in particular, I was quite excited. I think the title, The Long Live the Korean Empire, was definitely meant to convey both my enthusiasm as well as what I believe must have been the optimism and the hopes and joys of the Pak and other Chungin at the time. I may as well mention at this point that precisely for this reason, in the last 10 years, I've become more interested in this period. And I think when I lecture or teach Korea survey courses, this is definitely my favorite period. And in fact, I think I'm going to offer a course devoted to this period, the Korea in the Age of Empires.
Great. So in this period, as you demonstrate here in this chapter, kind of fabricated family histories became, as you put it here, invented traditions, right? And you talk about the implications of this for historical research. And we're going to see later on the kind of the implications of this longer term for how genealogies are treated and understood now as well. It's really interesting. So the chapter continues on with a chapter 5, that focuses in on this Wu family that you mentioned before. Mm-hmm. Right? So this sort of shifts our gaze from the Paks to the in-laws of the Paks. Mm-hmm. Why can you? So in a general sense, why was this shift important for the story that you're telling? And what are the most significant elements of this in-law story for you?
Mm-hmm. Ideally, the book should not have devoted a whole chapter to the Wus, but my reason for doing so was more practical, in the sense that we know a lot more about them. Mm-hmm. Stories are far more interesting, and in many ways, the family epitomizes what newly rising Chungin families such as the Paks could achieve in the best case scenario. But at the same time, in addition, contrary to the conventional the claim that the Chungin survived the transition and they made adjustments and that they prospered during the colonial period, the Wus were ruined. They just did not survive the transition, especially for financial reasons. And in the end, I decided that, okay, for a while, that the focus is away from the pox, but the benefits of devoting a chapter to wuzi outweigh the cons.
And some of them are really fascinating, right? One of them is involved in the killing of Queen Myeongsong. Yes. I mean, there's some really fabulous stories that come out of this. As a reader, I actually really loved that chapter in part because you really, this is one of the, actually several chapters in the book where you're bringing these figures to life in these really fascinating ways. And their interpersonal relationships become a really interesting part of the story. So after a chapter that turns to these in-laws, and again, some of them are really fascinating figures who just, you know, deserve stories of their own, right? We'd come back to the Pak family in chapter 6. Now, at this point, the Paks had connections with the aristocracy, with the palace, with the king. They have a big mansion in the city of Seoul, or in urban Seoul. And you look here at the what happens to the Paks in the context of colonial Korea, right? So as colonial subjects of Imperial Japan, as the subtitle of the chapter indicates. Now, members of the Paks had really different responses to the colonial state. Some eagerly served it, some resented it, and many, as you put it in this chapter, were struggling simply to survive it. So can you talk about this aspect of the story? What's most kind of important or significant about this particular context in terms of our understanding of the Pak family and of Chungnyeon in general?
This, in many ways, that chapter on colonial Korea is perhaps the most, the chapter where my political agenda, if you will, is more obvious in the sense that I am engaging the kind of historiography that highlights important people, the resistance leaders, anti-Japanese and resistance activists, intellectuals, and others from 1910 to 1945. In fact, although it's gotten much better with the mainstream historiography on that period, at least in the 70s and 80s, for an ordinary Korean person reading about that period, you would think that the right thing to do for a decent Korean person was to actively resist the Japanese. Actually, I take it back. Even today, every year on March 1st, there are all these enactments with the South Koreans dressed up, wearing the Korean dresses from that period, even some dressed up as a Japanese colonial police officers. But now these Koreans are waving their flags, they are demonstrating against the colonial authority. Koreans are demanding independence. And one would think that that was what every Korean, or at least a majority of Koreans, did on March 1st in 1919. But what I find interesting is that when you actually ask Koreans, almost nobody has any recollection or memory of such a figure from one's family, including my own family. So what this chapter, what I wanted to do with this chapter, was to emphasize again that most people just went on with their lives. And in order to do that, I also try to find meaning in the seemingly uninteresting details of ordinary pox by talking about, for example, the experiences of the younger pox girls attending school, what, for example, the Shinto worship meant for them, or change or adopting Japanese style surnames, and also the meaning of a Christianity for a member of the older generation, such as a Pak Tae-sik toward the end of his life, after he has seen it all, heard it all, before leaving, fleeing Seoul. So that I meant these stories, vignettes, the term I use, to be the main focus of the story. Although I do, of course, I do acknowledge more interesting, if you will, the experiences of the Pox who rose high in the colonial bureaucracy, such as this one police chief. I try very hard to make it clear to the reader that those are special cases rather than they're the ones who deserve to be the main focus.
Great. Thank you so much, Gene. Now, as we move to the epilogue, we move into developments after 1945. And you talk here about the attitudes of the descendants of the Pox toward genealogy compilation. So can you maybe kind of bring the substantive discussion of the book to a close by talking about some of those attitudes? What really stands out for you in contemporary descendants' attitudes toward genealogy compilation? Ramifications of those attitudes and practices for historical research?
Mm-hmm. To be blunt, I'm very pessimistic that what my book is advocating, that is, historians in particular, but the ordinary Koreans taking more interest in quote unquote the real history of their ancestors, their recent ancestors. The awareness spreads. It's hard for me to imagine that happening. And the time is actually not on my side in that sense, because further we're separated from the what happened before 1900. The memories are being lost. And also the quality of history education in general in South Korea has reached a low point, with the younger generation South Koreans are knowing far less about their history. They're taught far less than the older generations, including myself, were taught. But still, I wanted to use Chapter 6 to argue, to first of all point out that these memory blackouts and the imagined histories, especially at the family levels, and also the historiography, Korean historiography, history writings on Korea, that continue to highlight and focus on the famous people, is not helpful for us to achieve a better understanding, more nuanced, more multidimensional understanding of a Korea's past. And my overall argument is that in the end, the challenge or problem at hand is about the human agency when it comes to historiography.
Great. So, Gene, thank you so much for making the time. It's a really fascinating study on many levels, as I'm sure is really clear just from this hour-long conversation. And there's a lot, though, that we didn't have a chance to talk about. There's a lot of really detailed, very fine-grained analysis of these genealogies. There's a lot of material in the book that rewards a reading after listeners have a chance to listen to this conversation. Given that, is there anything in particular that you'd like to mention about the book that we didn't have a chance to cover?
Mm-hmm. No, I cannot think of any at the moment. It's somewhat related to the kind of answer that you may have in mind, that is that this book helped me think about a new project, which in some ways is similar, but the coverage span time wise and the approaches are quite different.
That's great. So I was just going to ask you what you're working on next. So yeah, would you mind talking to us about that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. My third book monograph project examines the descendants of the Goryeo dynasty, the Wangs, to be more precise, of the Kaesong Wang, how they fared in the Joseon society. The conventional wisdom, as well as what people commonly talk about and the kind of information one could come across easily, is that a year and a half after the 1392 dynastic change, the Joseon court carried out a brutal, well, I
I take the word that brutal attack, actually a massacre that was geared toward the exterminating presumably thousands of Kaesongwang who were around at the time. And the extermination effort was so thorough that that today about 20,000 Kaesongwang who live in South Korea can trace almost more than 90% of them trace their genealogy descent back to this one lucky survivor. And so I thought I could write a book on how his descendants fared after the storm was passed, in terms of, for example, the passing the examination, holding offices in the central government, their position as a local lead in the provinces, possibly even their roles as merchants in a more commercialized economy, and finally, how they dealt with sort of a subversive narrative that certainly questioned, if not criticizing, the legitimacy of the Joseon dynasty for overthrowing the Goryeo and the persecuting the Wangs.
Best of luck with that research too, Gene. That also sounds great. And I'll look forward to talking with you about that when it comes out as a book. Thanks so much for your time. It's really been a pleasure and I really appreciate it.
My pleasure too. Thank you. Okay.
You have been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks for joining us and we'll see you next time.